Thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and talk a little bit about that physical underlying variability that we've had a couple of comments already on the soil. And as we started talking with James and looking at some of the challenges that he was seeing, he was collecting all the data that he just presented, and they were still coming up with some differences or lack of differences that they thought they should be able to see. So we were in the process of working with some landscape scale cotton modeling, and so we started talking to him about how might we use that combination to tease out some of that environment versus genetic differences. So as we were talking, they're very interested in looking at crop responses to water deficit. And what they were seeing is they'd see good differences in the greenhouse, and then they'd take it to the field and it would be swamped out. They were missing it. We were working with a model that was able to look at that spatial variation from the soil side of things and start to make estimates of that variability down at the spatial scale that their plots were at, and definitely get down into the temporal scale that they were looking at that he discussed earlier. So as we went on, they were describing the fact that what they generally had to do was they had to rely on randomization and make sure that their reps were high enough to take some of that variability out, or at least make sense of that variability. But they were still getting overwhelmed in the field, and they were considering that was something that was going on in maybe the soil. The modeling that we were doing was taking samples, representing the physical soil part of that field, and then keeping track, accounting for the relationships between the physical variability and that temporal weather variability during the season, because we were seeing different expression over different years under different fields, under different weather conditions. So as we discussed longer and longer, they wanted to be able to model at the spatial resolution of the plots that they were doing, and we had a model that we were working with that was able to get down to that level. And it can look at the temporal variability at the resolution of physiological changes that they were interested in, because we're modeling on a 15-minute time step. And like he was saying, some of the things that they were interested in is on less than a day on the temporal scale. And so we were there. A little bit of background about the model that we were using. It's the Precision Agricultural Landscape Modeling System. It was developed by the University of Wisconsin in Madison by John Norman. It was worked on with by Christine Mulling and Christine Morgan also. And Robert Lascano had, in talking with those folks, kind of saw it as the next step from some of the precision agricultural measurements and research that we had been doing in the Southern High Plains. So he brought palms to the Lubbock area, and we were able to take it out and test it on some rain-fed systems. At the time, it was a corn and soybean model. And of course, we do grow some corn and soybeans in Texas High Plains, but we really look at irrigated cotton. When I started working with the model, I saw it as an opportunity to start representing those our pivot irrigation systems that we use so much of. And that was kind of the, one of the first times that James and I crossed paths. Is I knew this model was capable of representing that great amount of variability across the and spatial and temporal variability across these pivot fields. An example here that we're looking at, this is actually a quarter section pivot. It's a snapshot of 1 hour during the day, water content in the soil. You can see the pivot irrigation going around this field. That cycle can take 2 to 5 days. This field actually took 5 days, so you can imagine the amount of variability across that field as that irrigates over 5 days. So when we worked with, we started working with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, we're able to get irrigation put into the model, and we're pretty pleased with what we saw. We were able to represent this variability across these producers' fields. The other thing it's going to let us do is it's going to let us represent different irrigation treatments across smaller research fields. So we can represent that at the plot level. But again, this was a corn and a soybean model, and what we do in the Southern High Plains is predominantly cotton and irrigated cotton. So we wanted to add a cotton growth model, so we worked with them a little further. We picked cotton 2K, and we were able to test the Palms Cot version of the model on some producers' field in 2010 and 2011. We're pretty happy with the results. Now, there's some further development that needs to be done, but we're on our way. Just a little bit of background about how the model works. So we have a typical producer's field, quarter section pivot. We have different soil types across that area, different topography. Different pedology, of course. The model actually, it links the surface hydrology of each and every one of those grid points. And then at each one of the grid points, it's running the cotton model. So once the water infiltrates from runoff, then it's going into the cotton model. We're able to run cotton 2K at each one of the grid points. This is just some examples of soil profile water over a season where we were modeling it and then comparing it to neutron probe readings at that same location. And the nice thing here is that we're finding it's robust enough that we're not having to make the adjustments to our settings, our parameters, etc. To take into account different fields, different years, different extremes in weather. So we've found that the model is fairly robust, and we're getting information at each one of these grid points across the field. This is a little different than our experience previously when we were doing PA research, precision agriculture research, a decade or so ago, when we were kind of using the regionalized variable approach, or the spatial and temporal statistics. A couple of specific examples that I've worked with in the Southern High Plains, we looked at apparent electrical conductivity of the soil and how that could be used to predict texture, extractable ions, how it was correlating with these common measurements that then we wanted to correlate with yield. And we got reasonable approximations. We got good correlations with these and apparent electrical conductivity. But we always found that it was field specific, it was season specific, it was initial conditions specific. And so we needed a way to integrate those relationships and express them under different situations and different conditions. In that specific study, we looked at six different fields. Five of the six had good relationships, but at different fields, we'd have a flip of sign in that relationship. The sixth site, we really didn't have much of a relationship. We were actually doing some other research at the same field where we're using spatial autoregression or state space analysis to look at nitrogen, water content, and relative elevation across that field and use that to predict yield. But there again, we got good relationships, but it was for that field and that field alone, and it was probably for that season, the seasons that we looked at, and those seasons alone. And so that's the nice thing about this, the POMS model. We find it to be robust across years, we find it to be robust across seasons, and it's because it's looking at the mass and energy balance of that soil, plant, water, and atmosphere system. So it's continuously updating those non-linear interactions between the plants and the soil throughout a season. And it's using that mass balance to account for these differences. And again, we're finding that we can run it. It's not requiring recalibration between seasons or contrasting weather or landscape areas. And that's a very big difference, a very important difference than what we saw when we were looking at the empirical relationships and the management zone type research, where we found those were not being static over years or fields. So when we started talking with James, my idea was that the POMS model could be used as kind of a covariate accounting system. It's a ledger book. It's taking those soil properties that we were trying to get empirical relationships with, and it's using deterministic equations to update these. The input variables that we use, very much the same that we were measuring for the empirical studies that we had done. Soil texture, horizon depth, topography, so we're representing that physical part of the field. And then we're overlaying that with the temporal weather and current management. And it seems to be giving us a good idea of these non-linear water relationships that they thought were coming up and masking some of the differences that they wanted to see in the lines that they were evaluating. So the model's taking care of the infiltration and the water storage within the profile. That, of course, is impacting the way the roots are developing, the way the roots are aging, the roots dying, and that in takes up the nutrient uptake and gives us the differences in the transpiration and evaporation across the field. So let's talk a little bit about the specifics of what we're trying to do with the plant physiology group there in Lubbock. We wanted to look at a field there. It's a drip irrigated field at the CSRL. It actually has 22 drip zones across this field that they're doing experiments on. And the drip rows are 8 meters wide, and they're about 165 meters from north to south. And so we want to be able to do the modeling on about an 8-meter by 8-meter resolution. And we'd like to eventually get to a smaller resolution than that, but the data that we have right now didn't want to stretch it much more than about 8-meter by 8-meter. Now, this field is shared by several different teams. Plant physiology group usually uses zones to the west of the field. And we wanted to look at years that they actually had some field data so that they can actually go in later and start doing some correlations with the model results versus what they actually saw in the field. When they installed the lab there at Lubbock, they had the late B.L. Allen come out and do grid sampling and transect sampling. And at the time in 2001, each one of these grid points is about 30 meters apart. We thought that was a fairly intensive grid at the time. But when you think about that grid compared to the size of the plots, which is about 8 meters by 16 meters, we probably needed a few more samples. And that's something that we'll be adding to over the next few years to bring that the resolution of that physical representation down. But at the time, we thought it was a pretty good sampling. The zones within the field are automatically controlled. We do have a database that records when those zones were on and the rate of irrigation. But as I started digging in that database, that information is actually fairly well, it's way down deep in the database. These are just a couple of examples of where we need to kind of retrain ourselves of what kind of detail is important, because this is the detail that we can start to use now. Another important part of the model is elevation. We had some RTK data for the field, but USGS has some very good data out there, 10-meter resolution data that is readily available. So the data for the model, for running this type of a model, is there. Most of the fields that we're working on, they already have some grid sampling. We know what that irrigation scheduling is. We have ways of monitoring that, and we can represent it in the model. And elevation data is there. We're ready to go with this type of modeling. We have the data. The particular seasons that I'm going to talk about here are 2010, 2011, 2012, and 2014. These 4 years had extremes in precipitation and heat unit distribution. So we can take a look at that. 2010, we would consider a very wet year. One of the reasons we thought we would consider it a wet year, we had a full profile in the beginning of the season, which is important to our system in the southern high plains. We continued to get rain throughout the early part of that season with an extreme amount of rain in July, but then it kind of dried up. So it was wet early and drier later. 2011, no question about it, very dry season. We didn't have a full profile to start with. We got very little rain in the early part of the season. It rained a little bit towards the last, but not enough to rescue. It was the driest year on record. 2012, we might consider kind of in our median range, kind of the lower area of our median range. And then 2014, we would consider a fairly wet year again. So four very different years that we wanted to look at here. The irrigation amounts that they tend to put on their studies, he already alluded to them, are zero or a rain-fed situation, 1.5 millimeters a day, 3.0, 6.0 millimeters a day. And they put those on every day, until it rains 25 millimeters, and then they shut it off for 3 days. We, in the model, decided to apply those to the whole block, grow the same cotton crop across the whole block, and that might start giving us some ideas of what kind of variability we're seeing in this block, in this research field. Another representation of that irrigation, we can see the four different years. We've got 2010, which is that wet year, 2014, which was considered a wet year, but not as wet. And we got 2011 down here. One thing that's interesting to look at is that towards the end of the season, all of the slopes of these cumulative lines are the same. We really start to run out of effective rain in the last part of the season, and that slope is impacted only by irrigation, and you can see that throughout all four of those years. So just to get an idea of what the field, what the model was predicting as far as variability across that field, we'll start looking at cumulative transpiration, variability maps, and we'll look at four seasons, and we'll look at that 3 millimeter a day irrigation level. So here's our 4 years. We've got 2010, 2011, the dry year, 2012, the median year, and 2014, another wet year. We can start to see some patterns across those years. And this is something that we've seen in most of our precision ag research. But with the model, we're not looking at, say, a clay content, or we have some better idea of why these differences are here, because the model's predicting this cumulative transpiration over the whole season. But we can see that these areas, these features, they're expressed at a different level depending on the year and depending on a season. That's not surprising, but it's showing that non-linear relationship between what's going on in the physical part of that field, the physical variability, in interaction with the temporal variability. So when we first started talking about this, our usual suspects for this type of feature, you know, this variability feature in one of these fields, is one, where does the clay pick up in that profile? And how much water holding capacity difference is across that field? The other that's related is, where does the calcium carbonate horizon start to pick up in that field? And so that used to be kind of our first iteration of an answer for why there was variability across the field like this. Well, if we look at the maps of where our argillic horizon is, how thick that horizon is, and where that calcium horizon is shallow, which would be a lower water holding capacity, or where it's deep, where we have more water holding capacity, it really doesn't start to explain those features that we saw in the cumulative transpiration across those 4 years at that same irrigation. And that's because that's too linear of a thought. So we don't have to, the model's letting us move away from just those straight empirical first approximation relationships. So that was across four different seasons at one irrigation level. So let's take a look real quick at one season under all four of those irrigation levels. And again, we see those same patterns showing up in the field. Definitely at the higher irrigations, and of course they're being expressed at different levels depending on the amount of water that we're adding to that system. So this starts to give us an idea of where that variability is in the field, at least as far as transpiration. So we also wondered, is it just the transpiration that's giving us those features that we're seeing to be similar across years or across irrigation treatments? So another cumulative or integrative measurement that we decided to look at was cumulative photosynthesis across the seasons and across the irrigation levels. And we wondered if it would show up the same variability features. And sure enough, it did. We still have that very strong feature that kind of runs diagonally across the field. It starts to swamp out here at the 6 millimeter a day. There's just enough water in there to start masking some of that variability. But in the rain-fed, it's very strongly expressed. And so that's two integrative measurements or calculations of integrative measurements across that year, that field. And so these maps start to give us an idea of how much variability there is. And we, this block was considered fairly uniform. And yet we see there's quite a bit of difference predicted for it. So the next step is, how do we use that? What do we do? One of the things that we started to look at, started talking about using, is we know we have those 22 irrigation zones. They're already there. We're not going to go out and redistribute those. They're drip irrigation. We're kind of stuck with those zones. So one of James's questions was, how much variability is in each one of those zones? We're seeing that. We're getting anecdotal mentions that we're seeing major differences from north to south in each one of those zones. And that's why some of the differences that the physiologists and plant breeders are looking for, they're not seeing. Even though they saw it in the greenhouse, they're not seeing it in the field. So a representation of that we just decided to look at and begin to talk about was, we took the range within each zone, the range of values. This happens to be for photosynthesis, cumulative photosynthesis throughout the season, and divide that by the max. It's similar to what a coefficient of variation would give you. And we can see in the dry and the low irrigation treatment, that's 10% to 25%, that range compared to the maximum value within that particular plot. So that starts to comment on what level of difference might we be able to see, and it's not telling us that we're going to be able to see small differences. We're going to have to look at larger differences across this field. By the time we get to the 3 millimeter a day, and especially the 6 millimeter a day, okay, we're really starting to, then we can kind of swamp out some of that variability. But is that really what we want to do? Because what we started out looking at is these traits under deficit irrigation. And deficit irrigation is what's important. So in order to find differences, we have to water a lot, but we don't want to water a lot because those aren't the differences that we want to see. So that's where we're headed with this. And so this was a lot of chats over cups of coffee and trying to bring our two worlds together. One thing that really struck me when James was talking about it was the numbers that we're talking about. 500 varieties, 10 fields, 10 locations, and multiple reps in those fields. How do we start to break that down? How do we get away from all of those measurements? How do we start to make better use of those measurements? Our side of it was, well, we can start to model some of that physical and temporal variability and the interactions between them, so maybe that can help. And I really see it as an accounting tool. It's whether it's giving the exact photosynthesis or the exact transpiration at that point in the field, maybe not, but it's giving good relative answers and it's telling us where that variability is, and we're not having to throw that somewhere into our error term. So where we're headed, we know that using that energy and mass balance calculation, that model that's using the energy and mass balance, can do a decent job of predicting these temporal and spatial variabilities across the field. We also know from talking with the physiologists that right now any variability that they're seeing in the field is kind of getting thrown into their error term, and it's impeding their ability to see the differences that they want to see, even though they're making a tremendous amount of measurements. The future is, can we start to mix these two and start saving resources, time and money? That's the whole point there. And we're continuing to work on that, and we're getting some exciting results. At least seems like we're beginning to communicate and bring those two worlds together, and it's an exciting time. So I appreciate your the opportunity to be here, and we might have a minute or two for questions. Yes.
Do you have a thematic layer of the yield for the 4 years of the kind of all of the same pattern?
Well, unfortunately for this
question.
Yeah, okay. The question was, do we have a thematic yield map for the fields? Did I get that right?
For 4 years and the same.
We actually don't for that field, because those 22 zones are separated amongst four or five different teams. But we do for four of those zones. We have yield and all of the different measurements that the physiologists make. And so they'll probably be going back in there and taking those plots and comparing them to what the model was taking. So that's why we picked those years in this field, so that we at least had a starting point to do that correlation back.
So what are the other issues? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering why you said something about how you're using a deterministic approach and not the empirical relationship.
Uh-huh.
I just don't understand. Like, I feel like if you have access to so much data and all those third points, I mean,
uh-huh.
Why couldn't you just rely on your relationship and just sort of weight factors that cause variance and just reiterate? I don't really understand why, given so much data, a deterministic approach is still preferable over a deterministic.
Well, what the question was, you know, we already have all the empirical, we have the same empirical measurements that we were dealing with, and we have those on a grid basis, and we're able to represent the physical part of that field. And why don't we don't just use empirical relationships as say a covariance analysis, I would guess?
Yeah, or I don't know, like a analysis.
Yeah, okay. Yes, yes. Well, what we found when we were doing just that, in the last decade or decade and a half of using spatial and temporal statistics, we found that if you went from field to field or season to season or even parts of fields to parts of fields, we'd still have a good strong relationship to, say, clay content or the length of the argillic horizon and therefore the water holding capacity. But that sign for that relationship might flip from year to year or field to field. This doesn't. This is taking into account that physical representation of the field and using deterministic equations to predict the interaction with the changing weather. And those are nonlinear changes. So that we just thought we see this as kind of the next step, where we don't have to worry about that sign of that relationship flipping or it being there 1 year and it not being there another year. So that's our point of it. We still have those same measurements. Yes, we're using the equations that we have available to us to run that model at each grid location and try to make it more robust over changes.
That answer your question? Good. So from a practical perspective, I think Mike pointed out that anybody who's done a drought experiment in the field knows that as soon as you start pulling water out, all the variability in your field starts to jump out. Mm-hmm. The other thing is any plant physiologist who is naive enough to think that, oh, drip irrigation is great. We have, lines underground that are delivering 3 millimeters of water a day to the length of a 500-foot row knows in a year like 2011 that any small variability in your irrigation system is magnified.
Mm-hmm.
So a clogged emitter that you didn't see in the 4 or 5 years previous to that jumps out as a big dip in the row. And as James and I can attest, anybody who's walked along a pivot and tried to calibrate nozzles knows that the amounts of water coming out of nozzles and in drip systems is variable. So that's a layer that's not getting integrated into this. Are there people or are you guys working on trying to somehow map variability in water delivery across pivots or across drip systems?
I think there are, but that's a pretty hard problem.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where
a graduate student with a bucket and rubber boots.
Is it that's pretty good? Yeah.
You can set the truck in one side.
But how many times can you send that graduate student out? In the conversations over a couple of those cups of coffees, we talked a little bit about that. The idea here was to treat the field uniformly and see what the field told us might tell us if it was uniform, and then use that to go and look for differences, and trying to merge those two worlds is we still got some work to go, but I think this model does give us a good opportunity to represent the physical part of that field that we've heard a couple of times mentioned today. So.